Welcome back to another episode of the All Else Equal podcast, a original podcast with a name we think that's protected maybe by intellectual property right law, maybe.
Certainly protected by intellectual property right law. Today's guest is a former Notre Dame student whom Jason and I never actually taught, but we did interact with him through a nerdy economic policy club that we advise. Cole Falwell is a Notre Dame class of 2019 alum who was an arts and letters poli-sci major, but ended up working with Citigroup doing investment banking for the past 2.5 years. He's now gone off to work on a news startup, Roka News, and we wanted to have him on the podcast to talk about his experiences at Notre Dame, how they shaped his career arc, and ultimately have led him to the place he is today. We hope listeners today will learn a little bit about what it's like to be an arts and letters major, what it's like to work in investment banking, and hopefully come away from the episode with a deeper appreciation for the value of a Notre Dame degree, regardless of your college or major. Cole's also just a delightful guy to talk to.
That's right. Cole made me want to be an investment banker, I think, after listening to him. And with that, here we have Cole Falwell. Hey, Cole. Welcome to All Else Equal. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Of course. Happy to be here. Listen to your podcast in the past. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Oh, the one listener. That's we appreciate right. that.
No, our mothers listen sometimes. As a proud arts and letters graduate, how does it feel to have actually studied anything and done everything?
Well, I don't know if I've done everything just yet, but it does. You know, I think it speaks to what Notre Dame pitches, which is that, you know, you can kind of follow your curiosities and still end up on Wall Street or wherever you'd like to be eventually. And I think the one kind of maxim that was helpful that has been relayed to me by a handful of people that helped with the whole career progression was just everything you do is a sales pitch. So, you know, I studied political science at Notre Dame and somehow ended up in finance. And it was because it was that sales pitch. But it feels pretty good. And so, you know, now I'm doing the news. So it's a little bit of a switch, but I think it just speaks volumes about the ability to learn and the education Notre Dame gives
you. Can you talk a little bit about that path going from poli-sci, which is an arts and letters for our Notre Dame students? They know this, it's arts and letters. But for those non-Notre Dame listeners, like my mom and Forrest mom, arts and letters is a separate college from Mendoza. Mendoza typically, it houses finance, and those finance majors typically go on to investment banking, although not exclusively. Can you tell us a little bit about your path, you know, since you weren't doing the traditional well-worn finance Mendoza into investment banking?
Yeah, totally. So I think, you know, highlighting that path is important, because typically the Notre Dame students will be in Mendoza, you'll study finance or some other specific field within Mendoza, and then you'll end up doing 2 years in investment banking and then move on to private equity or hedge fund, something to that effect. So I guess my route was a little atypical in the sense that when sophomore year rolled around, I think probably like most sophomores, I didn't exactly know what I wanted to do. I knew that I was curious about the world and I wanted to systematically understand kind of what was going on. And I was looking at Wall Street as kind of this black box. They managed all these transactions, trillions of dollars go through the banks every day. And it would be an interesting place, if nothing else, to learn more about the world. And I guess condition myself to have a strong work ethic, things like that. And so I fortunately stumbled across like a handful of Notre Dame students within Mendoza that showed me the ropes, you know, passed along interview guides, tips, things like that on how to actually get the internship. And the structure of how these most bulge bracket banks work is you get the internship and then they almost recruit their entire analyst class out of these intern classes. So I just knew that I needed to get that, you know, penultimate junior after junior year summer internship, which I was fortunate to end up at Citigroup. I got a return offer from that and then eventually ended up, you know, working there for the last 2.5 years. I guess with the political science thing and when I mentioned sales pitch earlier, you know, I pitched it as I am a creative thinker and that, you know, politics are incredibly market moving. I mean, just look at what's going on in Russia and Ukraine and having a fundamental understanding of, okay, so here are the tensions here. Here's the history. Here's what happened in Crimea in 2014. And what does that mean for the actual markets? You know, how does that impact oil? What is Russia exporting? Why does that matter for the United States? Is that going to impact gas prices in Germany? Does that, you know, tie them down from a political, economic decision-making perspective, things like that. So it actually, it worked out pretty well, but obviously it was how I pitched it in the interview.
I want to talk more about kind of news and the cycle of news and kind of what you're doing now in a little bit. But for Forrest, can you tell him what investment banking means? I try to tell him, and I think you just see the glaze.
Checking accounts.
Yeah.
Savings accounts.
That's right.
Certificates of deposit.
Yeah, I guess maybe a good way of understanding it would be just through an example. So let's take a company like United Airlines. Most of us are probably flown on a United plane at some point in time. And every once in a while, they have to replace their fleet or buy new planes. And so the bankers will, you know, either get approached by United or they will approach United with this idea saying, hey, you know, I think you guys should buy a bunch of planes from Boeing. This, I think, is what it'll cost, but it'll be, you know, a net, you know, it'll be a good investment in the long term for X, Y, and Z reason. Here's how I think you should finance the deal. And it'll be a split between debt and equity, debt being like bonds, things like that, equity being kind of the stocks that you'd see. So you can issue that money to raise to buy these planes. And what they'll do is they'll, you know, work hard to make sure all the projections make sense. Talk to all of like the big, you know, buy side accounts, whether that's your mutual funds, et cetera, who are eventually going to, you know, buy the debt or equity, and they'll market the deal. And then once everything's finalized, it'll go down to the trading floor where all the trading desks will sell this new debt or equity. And then United will have all of this money that is underwritten. So let's say the fleet costs $20 billion. Which is a ton. That's a lot of planes, probably too much. but Citigroup and a syndicate of other banks would deliver that money to United so they could purchase those planes. And then we would have that $20 billion that theoretically we would need to sell off of our trading desks to the buy side. And then they would hold the bonds, they would hold the stocks. And that's kind of like how a, you know, rough transaction would work.
What is Citi getting in this? They're not getting United debt or equity, right? Or is it just like a flat fee that you guys are charging to make these particular arrangements?
Yeah. So every bank does it differently. It'll be a fee, you know, most times based on the size of the transaction. So if it's a really big transaction, like the recent Twitter deal, you know, I think the banks, the two main banks on that made some in the range of like $130 million. Don't quote me on that number. I think I just saw that in headline. But it'll be some kind of fee structure. And then there's another portion of it, which is a little less quantifiable, that comes from the actual trading part of it. So when we actually sell this deal and then trade it in the secondary, a lot of these deals, especially in the debt and I guess, you know, IPO equity issuances, there will be a ton of trading right when the deal breaks, is what it's called. And that will also account for a significant amount of money that would come to the bank that brings that deal.
Well, so it's why is Citi necessary? So Citi is like buying this on the primary market in some sense. Are they
in some respects?
Is that the right way to think about it? And then they're issuing it again on the secondary market. Is that the right way to think about it?
Oh, kind of. So, you know, that deal, the initial sale of the debt or equity would be the primary market. And then secondary would be, let's say, you know, you're a big mutual fund and, you know, maybe you got more of an allocation than you wanted. So you want to sell a portion of that because you just, maybe you don't have as much cash as you thought you did. You need to raise some money. You could sell that back to Citi or Goldman or whoever. We would take down the risk and then maybe try to find someone else, another mutual fund that wants more of this. So let's say Vanguard, you know, had $1 billion worth of bonds that they didn't want, they would go to Citigroup, we would take it down and then try to sell it to BlackRock, for example. That's a theoretical, but that's kind of like the secondary trading part of it, whereas the initial allocation would be the primary.
Okay. And so what have you been, so you've been at Citi for 2 years, or you were at Citi for 2 years, is that right?
A little over two and a half. So I guess if you include the internship, it'd be 3 years. but I did a variety of things there. I started as an analyst within the municipal bond group, municipal finance department. And then I eventually switched over to leveraged finance, where specifically I traded leveraged loans. So I wasn't like, I worked with the bankers, but I wasn't specifically on the banking side. I was more on the trading side.
Well, like what was something cool you were involved with? Like, or did it all suck?
Yeah. What are you allowed to tell us?
I won't get into like the specifics, but you know, broadly speaking, when I was in munis, I focused on a lot of tobacco securitization, which is an incredibly niche part of the municipal market, which was pretty fascinating. And then also some Puerto Rico. And then in leveraged finance, it was a variety of names, from anything from like consumer names, like, you know, Birkenstock to energy companies that you'd think of. But the tobacco stuff is, I think most people think of municipal bonds as kind of like standard state and local government debt, when there is an incredible amount of complexity to it. Almost any airport you fly through is going to have municipal debt. Notre Dame, I think, might actually have municipal bonds that are outstanding of all. Most universities will issue it. And the advantage is, you know, for people that aren't too familiar with munis, is there's a tax exemption. So the municipal market's about $4 trillion. 3/4 of that is tax exempt. And so when you issue tax exempt debt, you're obviously paying less interest. And so, you know, there's tax benefits there that if you have some kind of public good, makes sense to do. So with tobacco securitization, it was the late 90s, and all the states were suing the big tobacco companies at the time. I think at the time it was like Philip Morris, Reynolds, Lollard, and there's one other that I'm forgetting, but they claimed there's a bunch of false advertising going on. So we have all these health costs that we're incurring. People are dying. They have cancer, and you guys are to blame, quite literally. And so they decided, because so many states were suing, to consolidate all of the tobacco litigation into one big thing called the Master Settlement Agreement, which was an agreement between the tobacco companies and 46 of the states. I think 4 states that already settled to pay the states in perpetuity, a sum that's adjusted via a handful of different things like inflation and also like market share, for example. And that will go in perpetuity. And so the states decided to securitize it, i.e. bring that perpetuity of cash flow into the present. And they issued bonds out of that mechanism, which accounts for a significant portion of the municipal high yield market.
That's kind of fascinating. So a state, do you remember which one of the states claimed this perpetuity?
A whole bunch of them did. So Ohio is a big one. New York is another big one. California.
The 46 states. These are the states that received or are receiving a perpetuity.
Yeah. So there was like this big payment, and then it's split up into a handful of smaller payments that go to specific states. It's not like one big pool.
That's fantastic. So Ohio is bringing all of this money to the future.
Mm-hmm. From the future to today.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
So that they can use it today.
Mm-hmm. And so
way to go, Ohio.
Well, way to go, Cole. Right. So city is figuring out kind of like what are the right terms and the way to like sell this stuff.
Yeah. So the unique part of tobacco bonds is really their performance comes down to one thing, which is how many people are actually smoking. That's probably oversimplifying it. But you know, basically since the 70s, smoking rates have consistently declined, which is good. and depending on how much they decline will dictate what kind of cash flows eventually make it to these bonds. So the structure of a typical tobacco deal is you'll have senior bonds that will get paid first. They're, you know, almost always going to get par. They have great credit ratings from Moody's and S&P, and you're not worried about them. The more, I guess, complex part of the structure is the junior debt, which is going to be much more dependent on the rate of smoking and a variety of other things. So
you need that part, because there's some uncertainty about what the future payoffs are going to be. So you separate this into like very low risk bonds and then higher risk bonds that have higher yields.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
That's exactly right. So the bonds at the bottom of the capital structure, like the most junior, will have typically a turbo feature. So if, let's say, 1 year smoking actually increases for whatever reason, those bonds would or could in theory be accelerated, meaning their average life would shorten. And so the IRR, internal rate of return, of these bonds could be much higher than, you know, what was previously thought, which, you know, if you're a hedge fund or some other kind of fast money type player, that presents a huge opportunity for outperformance.
So you should be advertising cigarettes.
That's right. That's what I'm getting at, right?
If you're one of these big hedge funds, that's a bunch of these bonds, right?
Yeah. We don't have a full foul recommendation on that.
I can't endorse any of this, but there's a whole bunch of interesting things in the markets that happen because we were trying to, you know, forecast how many people are going to smoke every year. It's like, for example, when gas prices are really low, more people actually smoke because they're spending more time at the gas station and at the pump. So they'll walk in and go buy cigarettes.
All right. So I asked John Shim, assistant professor here.
Yeah.
In finance. I asked him, you know, sort of what percentage of people that work in finance are involved in value creation, right? So sort of lubricating the economy, you know, helping things work versus how much of finance is rent seeking, where it's like people stealing pennies from each other. Do you want to, he wouldn't answer my question directly. Do you want to give me a percentage?
I don't know if I can place a hard percentage on that. I think it really depends what part of finance you're in. You know, I think ultimately my grandfather had this funny theory that, I'm not sure if it's just too abstract of a theory to really prove, which is, I guess, a lot of theories. but it's that when an economy switches eventually to having services drive more than the actual manufactured good, it starts a precipitous path forward, because now you're dependent on other manufacturing economies to facilitate all your transactions. I'm not sure if that holds any water, but the point is, or I guess what I'm trying to get at is the service economy in the United States, simply financial services, has become massive. You know, obviously tech is huge as well. But there's a lot of transactions that need to take place simply for, you know, these banks to do well. You know, low volatility and low interest rates, that's a tough environment for banks. Ironically, you know, that's probably a good environment for most consumers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of a double-edged sword. That being said, there will always be borrowers and there will always be lenders. And that's, you know, fundamentally the purpose of a bank. And I think a lot of people will, you know, you'll hear of a CLO, for example, and be like, that's some Wall Street concoction that makes no sense. It serves no purpose. And it does, actually. Most of these financial instruments started as having an actual purpose. The idea being, you know, if I'm going to you, Spencer, I'm going to you, you know, Professor Reed, and I ask for a loan on my house, a mortgage. You know, if I just got it from Spence and he's taking 100% of that risk, if I, for whatever reason, don't make my mortgage payments, Spence has to mark that down to zero. He takes 100% of the risk. If you guys split basically my mortgage, where 50% of the money came from Reed, 50% came from Spence, now, you know, your risk is cut in half. You can lend your other 50% of your money to someone else. And in theory, you know, the likelihood of the other person you also lent money to defaulting is the likelihood of both of us defaulting is in theory lower. So the idea being, you know, if you, the more and more you can diversify this lending and package it so the risk is kind of sliced up and split and spread across a lot of parties, in theory, the more stable and secure it should be. And at the end of the day, the lower interest rate you're willing to lend at so that I can finance a house, which, you know, at the end of the day does actually help consumers if it's done properly, because it means, you know, you can take out a cheaper mortgage and potentially a more affordable mortgage to buy your house.
So as we transition to what you're doing now, Do you feel like what you're doing now is more meaningful than what you did, or just different?
I think it's very different. I had a great experience at City. I'd recommend, you know, if you're a little unsure of what you want to do with your career and you're in arts and letters and you're in Mendoza, I think, you know, for most people, 2 years on Wall Street is not a bad thing. It gives you a platform to jump into kind of anything, and it has legitimacy in the same way that an employer would see Notre Dame on your resume and maybe assume that you're, you know, a smart kid that's, you know, going to do the right things, has kind of a moral driven way of approaching life. I think a lot of banking institutions hold a certain value to other employers, where if I know someone worked at JP Morgan for 2 years, chances are they're probably pretty good at whatever they're going to try next. So I guess, you know, with what I'm doing now, it does feel a little more on the ground. I think it's easy to lose the pulse of really like every day when you're sitting on a trading floor, as ironic as that sounds, when, you know, working at a news company, our audience quite literally, you know, they need us to be involved and talking to people and just be curious about everything that's taking place and what's affecting everyone's life. So it's very different. I also think building something is pretty cool. You know, at City, I was realistically one of 200,000 employees. You know, now I'm one of less than 20. So the chance for kind of taking ownership and being impactful is way higher.
Was this transition kind of always in the back of your mind? Were you always thinking at some point I'm getting out of investment banking Wall Street, or did you go into that thinking, well, I'm a lifer here, I'm going to always stay on?
I really thought I was going to be a lifer, to be completely honest. you know, in high school, I was reading econ books and, you know, you read Barbarians at the Gate and Liar's Poker, which are bad examples. And I guess kind of like finance bro-y books, but it sounds fascinating. And, you know, when you walk into a bar and, or you're at like a dinner party with your parents and you're like, I'm a trader at Citigroup. Like there's an instant respect that comes with that, that as bad as it sounds, it feels good. And you learn a lot. It's a high pressure, high stakes job. Obviously it compensates you very well. There's not really that many downsides, other than the fact that, you know, sometimes it doesn't feel like you're contributing much, which I think Notre Dame students especially struggle with, because you're told, I think correctly, that, you know, this is your one life. You need to do something incredibly impactful that helps kind of the next person down the road and pay it forward. And it doesn't always feel like finance is like that. I think there are roles within finance that definitely have a huge giving back component, but that's not the case for everyone. And, you know, some people also want to be part of something smaller, a more dynamic team, which I think as I got farther and farther in, ask yourself, you know, do I see myself as one of the people 5 years in front of me or 10 years in front of me or 20 years? Like, do I see myself as one of these managing directors? And if the answer is no, or you're unsure, you should really think long and hard about, you know, you don't know exactly what you need to do or want to do, but you need to kind of follow your curiosity and trust your gut. And I think there was enough inside me saying that I needed to try something else before I spent an entire career in finance, just to see what it was like. And so, you know, there's a chance, maybe I go back into finance in 2 or 3 years. I did like it, but I had to see something else and I had to take a little bit of a risk. And as a 25-year-old, you know, with no girlfriend, I thought now is the time.
Any children?
No. Okay.
So the company, tell us a little bit about the company that you are helping to grow, because, you know, the news industry over the last few years, maybe even a little bit longer, has taken, I think, a beating, and like credibility of news and news organizations and outlets are always in question. And so why jump into this industry when, you know, it seems like it's an upward battle?
Sure. I think part of me likes the upward battle. I'll just preface this whole answer with, I like being at the table where things are happening. I think that's what partially drew me to Wall Street and a trading floor. You want to be, I think, in your career in kind of the flow of whatever you're interested in. So, you know, if you're interested in understanding how the world works, you need to be in a situation where you're going to see a lot of information flow. I saw it on the trading floor. I see it in the newsroom. And so I think there's a part of me that I'd read these articles where a private equity shop would come in and buy the Chicago Tribune or some, most times like smaller papers. And they found out that the real estate was more or less worth more than the actual news company, which is sad. And they would, you know, more or less put the news company in a position where they couldn't succeed financially, which is tough. They would sell the real estate or do some kind of leaseback. And as a result, it's had a pretty disastrous impact on local media, which is incredibly important for civic engagement. There's a lot of research that's actually gone into this and the importance of news. And, you know, there's something to be said about, we do live in a capitalist country. You need to adapt. And the way people are consuming news is changing. But that doesn't negate the fact that news is incredibly important for how things work, for where people get an understanding of certain policies and what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. And I really empathize with Roka News' mission. So Max Tui and Billy Carney were the year above me in Notre Dame. They also lived in Duncan Hall. And they saw this kind of need for a really matter of fact news company where we're not going to wade into kind of unnecessary culture issues, unnecessary like political discourse that, you know, we don't think is accretive to the general discourse or dialogue. It really is just partisan and kind of over emotional is how I would describe it. You know, let's rise above that. Let's trust our readers to infer their own opinions, and let's make sure that we have a really disciplined process around sourcing our facts and making sure that everything we're providing our readers is accurate. It's incredible how much faster fake news spreads than the actual truth. I think it's like 6 times faster or something crazy like that.
Isn't there a new news company called Truth, or a new social media company called Truth? I think it's endorsed by the former President Trump.
Yeah, maybe he'll be back on Twitter, and Truth Media might not perform as well. yeah, I guess the way things are branded,
it's tough though.
Who knows? Yeah, it is tough. And you know, that's an ever evolving like middle line. Like take free speech for example. Like you obviously shouldn't have total censorship, but you shouldn't be able to walk on the sidewalk and say whatever you want. And you know, the Supreme Court has grappled with that question for the longest time, and they still haven't come to an answer. You know, what are exceptions? What should be carved out? And finding the middle and like what is necessary to report on, what can we avoid? It's an incredibly heady and philosophical task, but I think it's a task we're willing to kind of take by the horns, which has been a ton of fun. And our feedback has been pretty astounding. I know I sent you guys an article in The Atlantic that talked about kind of like the last 10 years of America and how fractured it's become. But it's how kind of, there's a part of the article that talks about how the loudest voices are kind of coming from the edges of the political parties. And there's this huge kind of center that isn't necessarily as vocal about what they believe, but they also don't want to be, you know, brought towards the extremes by just simply voicing like what is otherwise a reasonable opinion. And I think we've tapped a little into that, and that's been the result of an incredible amount of growth. We have, you know, over 1 million people that follow us on whether it's our newsletter or Instagram. And it's because, you know, traditional media uses bias, they use violence, they use kind of playing on your anxieties to make money. And we didn't think that is something that's healthy in the same way that, you know, fast food, it tastes great, but it's bad for you. You don't want the salad. How do you make the salad more appealing? And so, you know, what we think that comes down to is more of a a human personal appeal. That's how you create stickiness without playing on people's anxieties and fears. And that's kind of what Roku's mission is a nonpartisan, healthy way of consuming news, which I think has resonated with a lot of our readership.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of ask you how, in a world where a lot of news seems like it's done for entertainment as opposed to sort of information or fact gathering or like learning about what the current state of the world actually is, like how you're actually going to attract, how are you going to attract that center and give a voice to the center when these other media outlets that give through different mechanisms give so much voice and credence to, you know, the fringe people on the right or the left or pick whichever dimension you want. And so you do think that, you know, a more humanistic approach, whatever that word means, like is a way to draw people in.
Yeah, I guess like, you know, the example that we've bounced around is let's take like a macro theme like inflation. You know, that's obviously not very partisan to your question, but it's a very macro level concept that I don't think is widely understood.
Well, it is partisan if Joe Biden created it.
That's right.
So which, yes, Joe exactly. Biden, which I have some family members who might subscribe to that.
Exactly.
Partisan reading. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
But yeah, so like you have inflation, right? And everyone reads that, you know, home prices were up, what, 20% in February or something ridiculous. And all these companies are thinking about raising prices. And there's discussion like, you know, my Chipotle bill has gone up, whatever. But it's all kind of circular. And there is, I don't think it's not understood enough. And that's because I don't think it's explained in a way that makes sense to a lot of people. So the idea is, let's take a macro concept like inflation. Let's find an NYU or Columbia PhD econ student, and let's walk through the West Village and build our own inflation basket and see, like, you know, how much have the prices of blueberry muffins increased at West Village bakeries? Obviously, you know, data is not the plural of anecdote, but that kind of anecdotal is the personal human appeal. But it also brings a macro concept like inflation to a micro level that, you know, while it is only a microcosm of what's going on in the West Village and not, you know, what's going on in Iowa or what's going on in South Bend, it's important. And it helps our readership understand, you know, why this actually matters. Because, you know, if you're looking at your personal investment account and you're down, you know, 10, 20% in real terms, and you're now paying a ton more for a blueberry muffin that you eat every day, that's a tough environment for a consumer. And I think it's really easy to lose how simple that narrative could be in all of the complexity of, you know, theories around inflation and housing prices and all these different competing voices that just ends up being kind of the white noise of like a baseball stadium when you're on the field. Find something that makes sense, that has a human appeal, and that can actually be useful to our readership. And I think that's how, you know, you get the stickiness without making the voices of the, you know, radical opinions necessary to create a following.
Well, if you ever need some South Bend professors to eat some blueberry muffins for you,
I don't eat blueberry muffins. That's a political statement that I make.
Well, I do. And Sally. Yeah. So I can help you figure out what pricing differences are in the West Village versus South Bend.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting.
We should probably wrap up. But before we go, Cole, maybe as someone who, you know, we think has charted Notre Dame, you know, the path through Notre Dame and afterwards in a very like admirable way. You know, do you have any advice for current Notre Dame students?
Yeah. You know, oddly enough, I think everyone gives like the advice, like, don't be afraid to fail. I think that horse is kind of be dead. I think some of the most important advice, or the best piece of advice I've ever received was, you know, once you decide something's the correct course of action, be incredibly aggressive. And obviously, you know, there is complexities to that. And I mean aggressive in the sense that if you want to work on Wall Street, you know, I had a buddy that literally would go into the lobby of banks, hand out resumes to people, and then, you know, call up to the trading floor and say, hey, I'm in your lobby, like, let me up. I want to pitch. Like, I want to work on your desk. It takes like a little bit of it's hard to do things like that. But if you really aggressively pursue what you want, even if you end up on Wall Street and you're like, this is not for me, it shows you the value of like how easy it is to attain something if you just make the calls and like consistently are persistent, you follow up and you push it the extra mile. Be aggressive is what I would say.
I like it.
Yeah. Same. Well, Cole, thank you so much for taking the time chatting with us. I know you are a big fan, our number three fan, All Else Equal, outside of Forrest and my moms. So, it's going to be hard to break into the top two. You got to beat our moms.
I don't know how much my mom actually likes the podcast.
Oh, no. So maybe you are in the top two. So thank you so much. We'll have you on again and feel free to reach out whenever you need anything.
Thank you, guys. We'll have to do the South Bend blueberry muffin, and maybe we can exclude Spence, but yeah.
Awesome. Always a pleasure.
You guys having me on.
Love you, man.
And best of luck to all the Notre Dame kids with their finals. You're going to crush it.
Always awesome getting to talk to Cole.
Yeah, agreed. I think that what Cole and Rocha are doing are admirable, really. We've seen how easy it is for news to become kind of like infotainment. We even talked about that. And sometimes even news becomes outright fake. So if you're interested in learning more about Rocha, you can go to rocanews.com/signup and also follow them on Instagram @RideTheNews. We'll put both links in the description of the podcast.
Stay tuned for an All Else Equal scandal next episode. As always, thanks for joining us, and you can reach us at allelseequalpodcast@gmail.com.